work with Provost Pritchard and trying to time that up and launch some time proposals today. And we'll also be talking about some ways that potentially Ryan's work could affect the plan and how we are talking about stream flow, tree mortalities, drought, and all these things, flooding as well, and how to bring those bare within the context of the plan. So Ryan, would you take that away?
Thank you. Question, Bobby. Did they PowerPoint get sent out at all?
Yes.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if I needed to completely reference what is on the screen. So I'll thank you. So I've been tasked with. Should I come up to the. Do you think the. Can you hear me online? Because I'm kind of far away right now.
Folks on the phone, can you hear Ryan?
Yes.
Okay. So I've been tasked with updating the climate change chapter, which is chapter 15. And then I'm also putting together a report that will be in the appendix, basically going into more details on the how I did the analysis and an expansion on some of the results. So in chapter 15, most of the results that I'm putting together for the chapter is being put into the section 15.3. Some of the other sections will be updated lightly to kind of reference, because some of them are slightly updated. But the bulk of what I'm putting together is in 15.3. And essentially, it's kind of an expanded literature review of, in my perspective, an expanded literature review of what is the impacts of climate change on California and the Sierra Nevada in general. And then I'm trying to add in, from my analysis, what are the specific impacts that we're going to see within the Southern Sierra region. So that's essentially what the draft of the text that you see, if you go through 15.3, I talk a little bit about how I do in the analysis. Basically, most of this analysis, and I'll take you through some of it, it starts from the global climate change models, which are very coarse. And there's many groups around the country that are doing and around the world that are putting together these climate change projections. And what I've done is, these projections are very coarse. They're often 100 square kilometers or 100 by 100 square kilometers. So to use then in the Southern Sierra, there's people that are doing downscaling, which is trying to relate those big projections and to smaller projections of, say, the ones I'm using are 4 square kilometer or 4 by 4 square kilometer projections of what the landscape will look like. So I'll go ahead and go through some of the results. Some of these are in the actual text in 15.3. And some of these are new that haven't actually been incorporated into 15.3 yet. So as I mentioned, I'm using downscale climate change projections. If you have any questions on how I'm doing any of this stuff, just ask me. So I'm going to kind of go kind of quickly. For most of these changes, I'm going to show you two different projections. They're going to be referenced as RCP 4.5 and RCP 8.5. The main thing to know is these are different scenarios going into the future. The 4.5 is kind of the optimistic scenario of the world kind of gets in line that, you know, we need to do something about carbon emissions over the next century. And this is kind of the best. There's a better case scenario, but this is probably the most realistic best case scenario. And then 8.5 is the if we don't really do anything and kind of a business as usual projection. I'm going to show you changes from when I refer to the historical period. It's looking at 1950 to 2005 for most of its analysis, and then I'm projecting up into the future for 30-year blocks from 2010 to 2039, and the next 30 years, and then the end of the century, 2070 to 2099. So on the third slide, I'll show this real quickly. This shows for the Southern Sierra region, kind of the changes in air temperature by the end of the century.
is what the current climate the models are projecting. This is kind of an average scenario for the from the models. We are going to see an increase in temperatures. It's going to be hotter. I don't want to dwell on this. Most of you, I think, know a little bit about this. But we're going to see changes of several degrees, and I'll put you down in a minute. Wrong way. So this is maximum temperature, slide 4 is minimum temperatures. You can see there's also a change here. The temperature here is in Celsius, but we'll go to the graphic on slide 5 to move things along. This shows you actually what's going to happen. So even under the best case scenario, you see the 4.5, and I think it's red, possibly, I'm colorblind. For maximum minimum temperatures, even under the best case scenarios, which is this reddish color, we're likely to have an increase of over 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, which is 5 or so degrees Fahrenheit. Right? No. It's going to be warmer everywhere. what can I say? Been a busy. So in the worst case, and then business as usual scenario, you guys have seen some of this stuff, so I won't dwell on it unless you guys have questions. This is annual temperature. And the seasonal time step, kind of the same story. Things are going to get warmer. What we've seen over the last few years with the record high temperatures is kind of going to be the story going forward, even under the most optimistic scenarios. This is the reality. When I do this, when I'm looking into the future, this is going to be our new baseline for everything that we do in the Sierra. Precipitation, on the other hand, this is on the next slide, which is slide number 7. Precipitation is not going to change necessarily all that much. The climate change projections currently project, go to slide 8. The current projections show a small increase in precipitation in our region, but the last set of projections that came out a number of years ago had a slight decrease. Basically, we don't know exactly what will happen going forward. There's likely to be a small increase or small decrease or no change in overall precipitation. So it's not really a going forward kind of. I go on the assumption that things aren't going to change very much with precipitation. What will change is the timing and how this precipitation is distributed. This is just average, but we don't have too many average years around here. There are a lot of studies that are showing precipitation volatility is going to get much more extreme. We're going to see there was just a study that came out about a month ago that showed that having severe drought years followed by extreme wet years is likely to increase like 50% or so going forward. So the scenarios of having droughts and then all of a sudden we have extremely wet years is going to be our reality. Go ahead, Bobby.
Is this from the downscaled projections?
This is downscaled projections for the Southern Sierra region.
Does that change at all if you don't downscale?
If you don't downscale this stuff? If you don't downscale, you have a pixel.
In other words, this projection, does that projection change if you don't downscale it? In other words, is there a continental effect versus a downscale effect in the precipitation?
I don't partially understand it.
Hypothesis for downscale projections is you get more refinement, in particular with respect to some of these precipitation measures.
I haven't looked at it, but I'm pretty sure the GCM pixels that sit over the Southern Sierra are showing a slight increase in precipitation. But it gets related. What they do is they often do back forecasting and they see how specific areas relate to, and it's not just the precipitation, there's other effects that go on. The people that do it, it gets sophisticated.
I think that for our region, the reason it shows an increase is basically 2 years where there's an El Nino event, and that those skew the entire average up, if I'm not mistaken. Uh, so that it's not that every year is actually more wet, it's maybe one or two events over a century that actually might skew the average higher.
It could be. I mean, I haven't delved into that part of the data yet,
And I'm telling you, that's what the past models have shown, is that when we looked at an increase, where that increase would be,
supportive with what they're seeing with the increased volatility.
Exactly.
Because if you're going to have increased volatility, you're going to see more dry. All the research that's coming out is showing more dry years and more wet years, or at least wetter years. And average, when we get an average year, we'll be lucky. And
the news came up with, or maybe it wasn't the news, but someone came up with a new term for that, which is weather whiplash.
Yes.
What?
Weather whiplash.
The planning for the boom and bust is going to be the name of the game going forward. So going, so I'm going through this very quickly. I could dwell on this stuff for quite a much longer. So if we move to slide, so the results I just showed were from downscaled models of precipitation and temperatures that come from the big GCMs. To go further with, to kind of understand what is going to happen to our snowpack, the stream flow, how much ET or evapotranspiration transpiration there is, you have to take those downscaled models from downscale projections, and then you have to put them into a hydrologic model and do further processing. It gets more and more complicated. So to look at how this change will impact the Southern Sierra, we did some additional analysis. We took those, we used the temperature and precipitation data that we just had, and we put those into a model called the variable infiltration capacity model, the hydrologic model that it runs at a 4-kilometer scale that we can run over the entire Sierra Nevada, which is what we were doing. So this is the stuff that might interest you guys. So when we do that, this is showing projected annual stream flow going into the future. So what you see here is the three different periods along the X axis. This is slide 10 for if you're following along at home. The horizontal line here, which I need to put in a different color, is the historical stream flow for the Sierra. Actually, I should take it back. This is for the Kings River watershed. We did this for a number of different watersheds. This is the Kings River. So this is the historical stream flow for the Kings River, around 390 or so millimeters. So going forward, projections from the VIC model show that we're going to see a slight increase in stream flow, in annual stream flow. I should clarify, this is the different, using the different global climate change projections. So the box plot, the range here is using different GCMs. So sometimes they show a decrease, sometimes they show an increase, but the black lines in the middle show kind of a median projection. So it's not a big increase, but there is a small increase in stream flow. But when you drill down into the data, it gets a bit more complicated. So even though we might see going forward a slight increase in stream flow, if you break that onto a monthly basis, you see that we're still going to have management problems. This is breaking the same data up by month. The horizontal line is the historical stream flow. And you can see that we get most of that increase in stream flow comes out in the wintertime. January, February, March, April, May. Normally, June is the peak for the Kings River watershed, and we'll need to reproduce this for a few of the other ones in the Southern Sierra region. Normally, June has been the peak runoff for the Kings River watershed. That's going to change to May. This is consistent with all the other projections that we're going to see stream flow several weeks to a month earlier. And then you can see the drop off in June. And in July, and we're going to end up seeing less stream flow coming out later in the season, which of course is going to be problematic with the reservoirs and such. Because I don't know if we're going to get it. I don't know when the rules change for when the reservoirs are allowed to, like Pine Flat is allowed to hold that water. So we're going to see the adjustment come in earlier, or see a shift in that stream flow.
I think I heard you say that there isn't going to be that much change in total volume of throughput. You haven't really talked about whether it's going to be rain or snow yet, but what I'm hearing is 3 to 4 weeks earlier runoff, but not necessarily a difference in volume. And so then it becomes a bureaucratic matter for Pine Flat to be able to hold on to its water a month early. I'm trying to get the implications for the kind of business that we do. I love that you've done the background science. I'm always trying to then say, okay, how are we, not to put blinders on, but to operationalize this.
Yes.
So as you go along, would you comment in that regard on how this actually is going to impact how we manage our watersheds, how water users downstream, the effects on their lives, all that part of it?
I'll show the next slide and then I'll come back to your question. So what is driving this? The main driver of this shift is what you just said, the snow. So the reason we're going to have the change in the timing is mainly a snow issue. So this is a peak snow water equivalent, broken up by a monthly time period. And you can see that going forward, we're just going to have less snow. And that's the main driver of what the stream flow, that's what's going to happen to the stream flow here. So earlier snowmelt. That's what's going to drive the changes. So what are the implications for, you know, if we're going to have shift in stream flow, it's going to come out earlier. And then it becomes a matter of, okay, even if we have the same amount of stream flow, we need to hold on to it. But we know that it's hard to hold. You can't hold on to water in the winter time because the reservoirs, they act as a flood control. You know, we can't, if we have extra water in February, it's not like, a lot of this depends on the year. I don't have this analysis in here, right, for this slideshow, but some of the other stuff I've done previously shows that even if we don't get too much changes in stream flow, on an annual basis or overall, during the wet years that a lot of this stuff. I'm merging two different ideas. Let me go back out from that point. Let's actually get into some of the stuff I want to talk about later on. It becomes an operational problem of how do we hold on to the water when we are still in the middle of flood season. And it's going to be an issue.
Why was it for stream flow?
This one?
What would be the projection of overall yield
for stream flow? Right now, the projection is the previous one, which is a slight increase in stream flow. It's a slight increase. So this is the historical amount of stream flow out of the Kings River, and then the projections are showing overall a slight increase. But to be honest with you, when I see a box like this. I kind of go, yeah, there's going to be, but it's more or less no change, no reliable change. To say that there's an increase here, it could be here, it could be here. This is kind of the range of what you should project. And really, when I look at this, even though the bars here, I just see no reliable change. It's going to be, might be a little bit more, might be a little bit less. It's a projection. That's within the uncertainty of going
forward. So, with tree mortality and
yes, the that's the part that this is missing right now. So this is an interesting story, and I don't have much more time to continue on my story. So here, I'll give you the complicated part. This is a hydrologic model. These are hydrologic projections showing what will change in the future to water, assuming that we have changes in temperature and changes in precipitation. What it's not showing you is what can happen because of the changes in forests. And that's really where the science is defined. And some of the stuff that we're working on, Pepper said, but we haven't scaled it up to operational levels, is we don't really have a good grasp of how these changes are going to work in combination with the vegetation change. So this is completely assuming that no vegetation has changed on the mountain. And to be honest with you, the idea that we're going to have the same forest at the end of the century as we do now is absurd. So that's where it gets really complicated. So if we move through the slides, I have one slide that shows stream 13 stream temperature, which shows, I got this from data from another researcher that provided it, shows changes in stream temperature. Temperatures are going to rise, which is obviously not great for fish. They're going to rise even more at lower elevations than they are for upper elevations. So some of these streams, especially when they're at low flows, are going to get extremely hot, especially during the summertime.
What was the elevation?
We're here, like on that long. This is the foothills. So this is 500,000 feet or so. Wherever that boundary is, the foothills.
One feature that you may want to pay attention there, that the large stream, incised streams, river corridors there, you can see the Kings and to a certain extent San Joaquin there. And you can see the temperature change is pretty dramatic there. That's the bottom of the valleys where the elevation is actually relatively low. And then you can see the north-south Kern River that is really problematic because, as Nina will tell you, we have three fish species that really care about cold waters in those. And then Steve, they really care about the salmon in that northern piece there in San Joaquin.
So it's not just a matter of the flow is going to change, the temperatures are also going to change. So it's just, everything magnifies or compounds. So the last thing before I wrap up here is, so this idea of what's going to happen, this is kind of where the, trying to put in some of the time for this analysis, but it's much more complicated. I'm trying to investigate what is the effect of forest mortality on the stream flow. And I won't get into too much of this. I'm using some of the Forest Service data, mortality data that they have, to get a nice sense of what's going to happen in the future. And this next slide is very crude,
Ryan?
Yeah.
Going back to the last slide, the last bullet, where you've got it. Climatic water deficit, annual precipitation, annual potential ET at a location.
Yeah, so this is the variable that I was going to explain in the next slide, but it's okay. I'll go to the next slide and I'll explain it there. It might be. So this is basic analysis. This, what you're seeing here is a lot of stuff. So along the x-axis, this is the last slide, 15, for people at home. But you have the climatic water deficit. So this is precipitation minus PET. So you can think about it as how much precipitation you have, how much water you have available, to how much demand there is for evaporation. Potential evaporation, this is how much the trees want to, if they had water all year long, that's how much they would transpire. So you can think of this deficit as how much the trees are lacking. So if you have just as much precipitation as you have potential evaporation, the trees would have water all year long. But once you get into this, you're getting into a deficit, so this is in millimeters, which is not labeled there. So to the left, the trees are going to get more water stress. Over here, this is just showing you basal area. Higher up is areas that are more heavily forested. And what I have plotted is shows the ignoring the line through there is the mortality. And if you stand back and look at it, you can see that most of the mortality happens kind of in this area that's above this line that I've plotted along there. So when you have areas that are very water stressed, most of those don't support heavy vegetation. That's where you're getting mortality. As you get into areas that are less water stressed, it takes a lot more trees. This is the idea that if you have the thick, the more heavier, the denser forests are the ones that are more vulnerable. Because if you have less vegetation for the same water deficit, you don't have to see the mortality. It's the really dense forest that you're seeing the mortality. So it seems to be mostly above this line. I'm not going to get into the details, but this is a kind of a quick and dirty analysis, but projecting how the climate, we can use using the precipitation and temperature data from the projections from the GCM, downscale GCMs, I can see how a location, the climatic water deficit will change in the future. We can make predictions on how the vegetation and the PET will change. And I don't show you those results because they're kind of hard to display, but if in the future, at the, say the end of the century, we had the same drought event as we just had in terms of precipitation, but we had an increase in temperatures that increased this climatic water deficit, basically the points moved this way, we would see about a 1/3, about a 33, I think it was something like 33% chance or 33% more mortality under the best case scenario, and about a 50% increase in mortality under the kind of the worst case scenario, the RCD 8.5, for the same event at the end of the century. So that's the kind of the, that's one of the, that's how we're approaching it. It actually gets much more complicated because the processes that are vegetation used transpire are very nonlinear and actually gets kind of, I would say that's very optimistic. Most likely it'd be much more going forward. By the end of the century, if we have the same drought event precipitation wise, if the trees are still there, it's gonna kill, I would, my gut is that it's gonna be much more severe. Go ahead, Bobby.
So we've had Dr. Bales come in. In fact, he presented in December. And subsequent to that, there was a pretty good Sacramento Bee article, Fresno Bee article, a couple of those that cited Dr. Bales. And one of the things that came out, and this is one thing early in our discussions that we had, was to try to communicate some relevant facts and figures to the public. So like a lot of the public does not understand traffic transportation. And one of the figures they used was that in the Kings River, during the drought, because of the mortality, about 200,000 acre-feet of water was potentially not about to transpire and that that stayed in the stream. Could you put that figure maybe into context for the group here? Because I think that is, those are some numbers that, like you're talking about some of the change in timing, that would present serious challenge for not only infrastructure communities, but then also like even the farming community as well.
Well, can I piggyback on that?
Okay.
Has that been validated?
Or what?
Or is that an assumption?
The numbers that? The
200,000.
It was from a study, I'm trying to remember which, Roger. There was a study that, when did it come out? I don't know.
They're pretty hot off the press, as far as I know. There were three, yeah. There were three, and he in December when he presented early, it had not hit the press yet. So it was
like, yeah, that's right. That's why I'm confused, because I was thinking about it. I'm like, I came out of this in the spring recently.
Yeah, he didn't want me to share those early slides at Redwood.
I actually remember that on the column.
Yeah,
so it's using data. The way he did it was it actually, you're asking, was it actual numbers? Or is it a,
kind of like a developed assumption?
There's assumptions embedded with
verified or validated.
There's assumptions embedded with any of these projections. We're trying to.
In other words, it wasn't something you could measure.
No, we can't directly measure how much the change in water from the drought. I mean, like how many from the trees?
No, yeah. saying,
What they did is they were able to do, what they've done is that at the CZO, and there's a few of them.
CZO is Critical Zone Observatory.
At the Critical Zone Observatory, which is located near Schaefer Lake, there's a set of flux towers along the transect. And there, we're actually able to measure how much ET flux is. So, one of them is located, there's four of them, and two of them, Sobrut in particular, had a lot of mortality. So, they were able to measure the changes for that point. They were able to measure what the difference in evaporation was. They only have it for that point. They used some other data to kind of scale that up and estimate what it would be for the watershed. I don't know if it's actually 200,000.
So it would have been based on the amount of precipitation that occurred, that be measured, and then there'd be a screen gauge to show what the yield is, and they would correlate that based on historical data.
What they did is it's more of understanding what the changes in ET were. I believe from their study, I need to go back and look at the study, or you'd have to ask Roger. But they're looking at how the changes in vegetation, or in, if you have mortality, what is the change in ET? And they used remote sensing data to look at vegetation across the entire watershed. And so they were able to extrapolate what is the changes. If they saw a decrease in ET, there's an assumption that will probably make it to stream flow. I'm not sure if they calibrated against the stream flow in that study. There's a number of studies that I have missed. I have floating through my head, so I can't remember if it's the exact one. Sometimes they actually calibrate against the gauge that's on the Kings River, and sometimes they kind of do this remote sensing.
Well, this research is so important because downstream interests or users for ag and M&I, when they see a number like 200,000 acre feet, they go, that is a lot of water. And the question is that what was truly yielded? And is that something in which then going forward you can use that as a base assumption?
It's our best. I would say that 200,000, you know, would be the best estimate that we have now of what the change is. Whether it is 200,000, I can't tell you. Models are inherently flawed and inaccurate, but it's probably the best estimate we have of what is the change. And we'll never know exactly, but we have to. We can try to refine the models and test them and get a better, more refined answer. But I mean, I don't know.
So
100,000, 300,000.
So that nevertheless, potentially, if you were able to manage forests and do that, you could potentially reach an additional water supply. Is what the basic tenet of that assumption and that tantalizing figure, I think, is. And I want to ask the folks in the room if, given Ryan's presentation, the ideas about mortality and density, ideas about changes in the timing of what could be about the same precipitation amount, what does that make you think in terms of water management for our region?
I think this is really important to go further on the research to understand it. But when there's numbers that are put out there with the media and then others, they can run with that, and you never know what kind of decisions are going to be made about as comes back. It's a closed loop process for forest management. And we may create a bigger problem as a result. Because that's a granite, very thin on soil, very tight fracture. There's no underground rivers, but people think there are, and if you drill deep enough, it'll be like oil. Show up. then on as it relates to forest canopy and with the mixes and things of that nature, is we did it for the lumber industry and that got us in trouble, right? You know,
so
saying this is the preferred species, blah blah blah, and all that. But then Mother Nature comes in and all not business as usual. And now they're talking about, at least through our collaborative, that it's the cedar and black oak, savanna, you know, groves. They're calling them groves or orchards. That those would be the two dominant species in that, say, that transition, right? Mixed conifer, oak, 3,000 to 5,000 foot elevation. I mean, there's a lot of things you have to look at. And then over how many years? We're just on the front end dealing with all the existing stands and with that volume as well, in order to be able to get to reforestation.
I'd say that going forward, like going back to your other comment of what is the actual, you know, effect of the mortality in that 200,000 and how it goes around. That's one study. For me, I'm much more uncertain on what the overall effect is. That's one approach that Roger used to see what the effect is. It's just one study and one approach is kind of a top-down approach. When you go at it from other angles, some of those results, or some of those increases, not necessarily disappear, but get shifted, and there's a lot of nuance. To be honest with you, I don't think we have a very good grasp. So the idea of that 200,000 circulating around and becoming, you know, maybe more concrete than one,
like the gospel,
that's where I agree that that's not very. We just don't have a good idea. We need to do a lot more. There's a lot of stuff that's, I think that's where the science is. We have a really firm grasp of what temperatures are going to have the effect on snow and the timing. And that's pretty much, people have been looking at that for the last 20 or 30 years. The mortality and the changes in vegetation, people are only starting to look at that hard in the last 5 or so, 10 years. And that's much more complicated. So we don't really have a firm grasp, I think. So when you hear those numbers, you're smart to take it with a grain of salt.
So if you go back to your prior slide in the bottom bullet, talking about precipitation and, well, water deficit. And you know, based on the California Water Plan and for Tulare and San Joaquin, we import water. We have a water budget that's a deficit, and the only way to make it equal is to import water, and then additionally is to extract water, groundwater. So everybody's trying to figure out how can we get more water to put back into our savings account. And it really all it is slowing down the downward trend. And that's why that 200,000 acre feet, because of the fact that in our region they're looking at storage as the way to capture more water. The question is there more water? And it's not just reoperations could manage some of, quote, that flash event. Or you manage flow, those waters, and then you do storage like water banking, you know, groundwater recharge.
That's where I think it's going to be where it needs to go. Because having more, the reservoirs are inherently flawed because you're using them as a flood control during the wintertime. And you've never,
especially during wet years. When you have the during wet years is when you have all that water coming through, and know that that's when you can't hold it, and you're never going to be able to. It's the water banking that's going to be kind of.
So that's why I'm so focused on quote water deficit. I hear you're using it in terms of climatic water deficit, which I think is really important because people are operating on certain assumptions, and then again, it just circles back into forest management and how we manage those critical watersheds. We're working off of the wrong assumptions and may not be that good of a job.
Well, I want to invite folks on the phone to ask some questions now if you have them or clarifying comments. And then what Ryan's presentation makes me immediately think of is, for questions for Ryan, you see Merced, are there areas that are more or less vulnerable? And we saw the stream temperature. That can make us think about areas that might have refugia, or might be more vulnerable, for example, to warming, and permanent warming, which can change a cold water fishery to a potentially warm one.
So that's at least in the mortality.
Yes, and that is actually probably what is currently happening up in the high elevation.
So the vulnerability question is.
We have seen a warming at night. These are streams are not cooling down as much at night, and so that has changed the overall conditions for which our native bony trout. Depend upon.
So, that where we could do work like thinning or burning or any of these other activities, that's where I think the questions, it'd be nice to have some sort of analysis about that or identify, and I think that belongs in our plan in other places, like where can we be relatively sure that there might be some cold water conditions that persist? Where can we be relatively sure they're not going to persist? Where is forest going to stay? Where is it not? Are there particular areas that have, for example, we have canyons here that are incredibly in size. If we increase flooding, does that impact erosion? Does that impact flooding? And is that particularly sensitive in certain water? So that's where it kind of that makes me think.
No, and that's exactly what it's the same thing that's on my mind, and kind of where I'm. One, I would like to take the mortality research and drill down into it. It's a much bigger question than will be answered for this report. It's a, it's everyone's question is what's going to happen going forward? And the tiers are going to change quite dramatically. We've been focused on the lower boundary of what mortality, and we're going to have changes from forests to shrubs or to grasses. When it comes to water, there's actually at the upper, this is kind of longer, but in the subalpine zone and up towards upper tree line with climate change, we're likely to see an expansion of vegetation, which is going to have the reverse effect. So you can think we're going to have less vegetation at the lower elevations, and generally speaking, smaller vegetation uses less water, so there's going to be more stream flow. But we're also going to have vegetation expansion at the upper elevation. And it's going to be, what is the ultimate effect on stream flow is going to be a balance between what are we losing versus what are we gaining. Now, one of the things that's going to slow down vegetation growth at the upper elevations is the fact that if anyone's hiked up in the subalpine zone, there's no soil up there. So one of the big limitations is how long will soil development take so that trees can get established? Because you can take out trees at lower tree line, shrubs will come in, grasses will come in, no problem. If there's no soil at upper tree line, you might see a delay of 100 years or 200 years. So in my mind, I can see a kind of a contraction of the trees of the forest on the mountain later on, followed by kind of an expansion at the upper tree line that will happen much long after we're all gone.
One of the important things that I think Roger brought up too was the fact that, how, just like you said, it's so less weathered that there really isn't the storage capacity in the soil for any water.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, instead of feet or meters thick, it's inches.
So this is, and this is a question that no one, people are just now, I know in NSF, some people are putting some funding for kind of understanding what is the, how vegetation changes over the entire mountain will affect water. And really, that's what we need to understand is what's going on in the upper and lower parts of the watershed. And we're concerned about generally the mortality in the lower tree line, which is, you know, appropriate. But there's a lot more to it. When it comes to water, we don't have a firm, we just don't know yet that this is where the science is, and we're trying to learn more, but things are changing.
Any further questions or comments? Ryan,
Bobby, this is Carol, who's getting at a question, I think, for Ryan. At the April 30 meeting of the Watershed Connections Collaborative, Roger Bales mentioned that he is in the process of developing a Sierra Nevada-wide restoration program going after greenhouse gas funding as a major climate change adaptation effort. And I'm wondering if you've discussed this with him. It would be interesting to know what he's planning to try to do, get funded in given everything you've said. Is this going to be a possible one? I just wonder if you know more about what Roger is thinking of doing, and that could be helpful to know about in this context of this discussion. I don't know much about that project.
I've only been working with directly with Roger for a few months now, and Roger has his hands in a lot of different places, so I don't know. I'm not familiar with that particular project that he's has.
Okay. That's something I think we're going to want to, I don't think we need it for purposes of this particular chapter, but it would be interesting to know what he has in mind and what impact that could have. So I'll just leave that out there for future follow-up.
Well, I think that's a really good note. I just want to add that what I've asked Roger and Sophie to think about is can we create another project? Could we utilize this research to create not just implementation projects, but is there an opportunity for us to continue the research at some level? So maybe one thing we can ask as a final is, like, where would you like to take the research in terms of water management? And that may be something we can turn into a proposal. Carol, does that sound?
That's a great idea. Great idea.
Okay, so I have consensus on that. It's an action item. We want to make sure that we shake Ryan very vigorously and see whatever sort of proposals and scopes of work come out of him at the end of this process. Okay?
That's fine. I'm happy to
Steve. Again, looking at water, you know, as a natural resource and hope utility for beneficial use, and those who are very interested in that, there's under Department of Water Resources a map, maybe you've seen it, that talks about EPO references and zones in the state of California. It hasn't been updated since 1999, and it seems that now, based on the more we're starting to know or understand climate change, we think we do, that maybe that map would be important to be looked at for revision, since it's used, you know, it's supposed to be commonly used as a reference.
Yeah, that would be great.
And one picture is, one map can be 1,000 plus words and or questions associated with it.
Other comments, questions? Want to move on?
Okay, I'm going to turn it back over to Mary. And I think what we need to do now is discuss this vanished page. I have this map up, and I don't know how else you want me to proceed. I'm happy to take direction on that. But I think what we also need to discuss is timeline and come to a consensus on what we're doing over the summer and some deadlines. We've already kind of powwowed a little bit about this in terms of what we'd like to see. But we need to make a firm proposal to the group and have buy-in or consensus regarding that. So I'm going to turn it over to Mary.
Can you just go back to the slideshow for just a moment?
Sure.
And you know, this is a new chapter for our update for disadvantaged communities. The purpose of the chapter is to identify disadvantaged communities and economically distressed areas, to identify environmental justice concerns, identify long-term outreach plans going forward, and then identifying DAC and EDA needs and priorities for projects. So, we are well into the development of this chapter, but I think there's some important feedback that we need to get from the group, and I've identified the main action items here on this slide. Before I get into that, let me just tell you what we've developed in the chapter so far. So the format of the chapter right now, we have a brief introduction where we elaborate on the purpose of the chapter, and then we launch into the definitions, the legal definitions, if you will, from DWR, for instance, for what a DAC is, the median household income of less than 80%, statewide median household income. And then the definition, as well, of an economically distressed area, which is less than 85% statewide. So we don't go into discussion on that. Then we get down to identifying what the communities in our Southern Sierra region are that are VACs and EDAs, or VACs primarily. And what we're looking at, and a lot of this is because of the way the census data is put together and how fine-grained some of the data is. Some of our little communities that we have are very tiny. They're just like little water systems. They might be swallowed up by a large census data group, and so it kind of skews the data. But we think we've identified approximately 16 that are legitimately verifiable by the data that we get our hands on. They act in the area, and Bobby, this is where you can put the map up, I suppose. This is the preliminary map that we have so far. It needs some embellishments. We need to label all of these locations, but what these mainly are, the little green areas, the green dots, Bobby, if you could point to one as an example. Yeah. So that's a water system, if you will. So there's a small little community that's being served by a water system, and so we define it by the water system boundary. Then the golden colored square areas are predominantly mobile home parks.
I can verify that one.
Yeah. And so we have the list of 16 green dots and the yellow squares identified, and we do kind of a rundown of the population, the median household income within that area, what percent they are in the statewide income, and that sort of thing. So we'll have that table, you know, completed with all the data.
The one thing I want to point out about the map that's really interesting, and we don't have a policy right now to deal with it. I actually don't know where the county boundary goes, but I think there is a portion of Kernville that is in our region.
on how you define Kernville, I suppose.
Yes, exactly.
It's not
incorporated.
Community,
exactly,
so
right.
It doesn't really have any corporate boundaries per
That's
se.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's another one right there.
Kernville is solidly within the county.
Which county is the question?
So it's part of Kern County, part of ours?
No, our boundary is coincidental with Kern County's boundary.
Okay.
The issue is that we have actually heard from
so
folks who live there.
The Kern County boundary, if you have ever got up to Hot Springs and up into onto the fourth that way, or that right around there is where the boundary is between Tulare and Kern County. So on the Kern River, it's about Johnsonville.
No, it's not.
It's south of there.
No,
it's well beyond Johnsonville.
I just sent some maps.
Yeah, it's way beyond
that. It's the Kern County line, and there are systems right on the border here. My comment is relative to how do we serve those groups that are on the boundary. The immediate solution comes, and we have an actual MOU with the Kern Irwin, because these folks screamed really loud when we were forming. And they said, we're concerned these folks are not going to address our issues. So in our MOU, we have an agreement that says if they're not able to get service, they can come to us. This is how we negotiated that there's a giant straight line right here. Because otherwise, you were going to do something very nice and wiggly. Okay? So I just want to bring that issue, potential issue up of how do we address those. There is some potential collaboration. I know that some of the downstream urban groups are trying to address the DAC issue, and perhaps that's one thing we could bring up in our Tulare Lake DAC forum. Is that there are some boundary issues in terms of like actually serving the community. Maybe that's one way to open the suggestion. That's one thing that jumped out at me. I do like that.
There's a rafting put in Kernville somewhere. If that's in Tulare County, should we consider Kernville to be rafting?
You know,
nowhere in Kernville in Tulare County. Nowhere.
But how do you
the
find
boundary
Kernville?
Is to the north of there.
How do you define Kernville?
Nowhere in Kernville is, but if they are wanting assistance because the Kern County one won't help them, I think we have plenty of underserved communities within our area.
Okay, so we have...
Who might take higher priority.
We have a list of 16 of those, and then I interrupted you.
So we'll complete the table with all the household income for these 16, which, like I said, are primarily little water districts or little mobile home parks. If after you review that map, if you're familiar with something that doesn't seem to be shown on that map that you want us, and you can identify what you think it is, like, oh, well, I don't think I see less than such mobile home, or I don't think I see less than such water company on there. Let us know, and we'll dig into the data a little bit more, but we think we've gotten everything.
If I may, Barry, there's three mobile home parks within the vicinity of Albury.
In the interest of moving this along, I could read the list real quickly. I'm sorry I don't have it for everybody, but we have Doyle Mobile Home Park, Lake Success Mobile Lodge, which obviously is the Tuleyville Water Company. So I'm not sure about that one unless it's right on the edge of the foothill area.
I think that's the one that's right on our boundary.
I think it probably is. Okay, and then Pine Flat Water Company, the Community of Cozy, which is one of those in the southern area there by
White River.
Springville Public Utility District, Kern, River Kern Mutual Water Company, Sierra Glen Mobile Home Park, California Hot Springs Water Company, City of Heartland, which is in northern Tulare County, Baker S. Ponderosa Trailer Park, Riftwood Mobile Home Park, Kings Canyon Mobile Home Park, Mary Lou Mobile Home Park.
That's one. Mary Lou?
Purdue, Mount Ararat, Mobile Home Park,
yep.
New Auberry Water Association,
yep.
Oak Knolls Trailer Park, Rio Vista Mobile Home Park, River Retreat Diesel Water Company, Sandy Creek Village Mobile Home Park, and Trailer Isle Park. So when we get this chapter complete, it will be coming out to you very soon. We can run through that list and see if you can think of any that we might have missed.
Okay, so that's an action item two in one there, which is Provost Pritchard will send out that chapter in draft form. We will distribute that, and that will come with a deadline for comments. And then the goal there is for folks to really review that and make sure that there's nothing in there, or nothing missing there. And one thing I want to point out with this is that I did forward Owen and Mary the DAC maps, and there may be some data associated with that for both the Mountain Counties and Tulare Lake funding. Those were not mapped. I think those were mapped with the census block. And I know that you guys already have that information for the Tulare Lake side, but you didn't probably for that Mountain County side. So I just want to remind you about that, that those are another source that is maybe valuable to include as a appendix or something else, or if you guys might want to redraw those, just simply because what they show is kind of what you're alluding to in terms of the nuances of the data. There are big tracks, though, that show up, and I think that's an illustrative tool to show very large tracts of DAC land, because there are people who live there. They're not in any density, but they're spread out in that area, and that is actually part of the nature of our region, is that they live in very sort of disparate corners of that sort of particular census tract. We've encountered that in eastern Fresno County, Lakeshore, and some of these others, and there are a couple that pop up as DACs there that are not on our current watch list.
Was that the information that was displayed on the map that went in the grant application? Okay. I saw those maps and I wasn't sure what.
What I'm sending you is some. I sent you something more recent. I think it's similar to that though, because I think
the indoor mapping tool, the online mapping.
No, this is some of DWR's data, but the first Mountain Counties has produced that their institute for that proposal, I think it was. Your water group.
Yeah.
And then for the Tulare one, it was Provost Pritchard did that. You guys
there were actually a couple
from
the because they were masked in this larger area, we weren't sure. But we took off the list because the Tulare County study apparently had built into those.
Okay, that can be helpful. All I'm saying is the map you guys have is really great. It shows the water systems, but doesn't necessarily show the populace. That may be important to showcase, and I'm just asking that might, some of those maps, take a look at those, see if there's something else we could do there. This map is very useful because it does show where we can engage in the water system, and that's very important. But it isn't the only aspect. For example, some of the others outside the water system are using wells, which that's the predominant situation in our region. We don't want to ignore that aspect of either, I think.
Well,
yeah.
Realistically speaking, there's not a great deal to be done for individual household wells that may not.
That might be true in a certain sense, but the other way to turn that is that you can turn those into a water system. So some of those companies can be consolidated, or they can do strategic planning to determine if they can actually have the capacity to add or not. And that's a very important aspect. In fact,
right.
Actually,
that's a function of land use. So I was thinking that you were talking about the scattered settlement pattern. And so now you're a mile and a half away from any possibility of a water system, and the well is a craft well, I don't think that there's a lot we're going to do about that.
Good. Yeah, that's a good point. What we had in Three Rivers as a kind of supporting that point, but also the need for data, is that what we found in Three Rivers is not all those wells. We consider the number of the 600 that they looked at did not meet class one. And that is a data point that's truly very important, and that we could potentially do something about. And it might be something that, again, for our.
So is there a PUD or something nearby
rivers, and this is unique to three rivers, but not in concept, the idea is to potentially expand the community services system. And that would require a particular process that involved LAFCO, but Tulare County brought it up to me. Their planners brought it up to me and said, what if we were to go to LAFCO and expand the boundaries of the CSD to incorporate these other pieces? That's an important piece there. Again, that might encompass folks who otherwise might be on it.
Absolutely.
Why would you wait? Anyway,
that kind of situation is absolutely
right. Thank you, Nelson. That was a really good nuance there, too.
Okay, then the next part of the chapter goes into some background narrative description about the economic conditions and trends of the region. And at this point, I wanted to ask the group if anybody is aware of a document that has a fairly up to date, good description of foothill and mountain area economics. There's tons of stuff about the communities on the valley floor, but there's not a lot of good description about.
That's the Chambers of Commerce. And there's one in Springville and one in Three Rivers. There's the Shaver Lake Chamber of Commerce, also really active. They may actually have a little bit of data. Fresno County has some data.
They have that socioeconomics.
And then. Go ahead, Nina.
This is Nina. I think they might have. I know they did an economic analysis, you know, a four-plan assessment. And I'll ask Mark Metcalf. He's our economist, and he's working on the fourth plan. So let me see if he collated information from all those sources and has some information on the economics of the mountain areas on the Sierra support.
I don't know if it was Mark, but somebody, he may have been the same name, someone did in the Sierra Nevada, who was his project, the SNAP, that study has a robust.
Yeah.
Is that the same guy?
Mark Metcalf?
Yeah.
He's been around for a while.
So it's a Sierra Nevada ecosystem project.
And that's why I asked.
That's a really good baseline.
Yeah, I know. Again, if you guys are familiar with these reports, I'm writing some generic terms here.
Okay,
but
what Bob is talking about is a SNAP report. Ask Barbara Johnson where the most extant version of, or set, they're like six volumes. Now, right now it's almost a 20-year-old report.
That was why I was saying Mark Metcalf summarized a lot of information in 2015 or 2016 on the economy and I'm pretty certain he may not have looked at the nested communities. He may have been looking at the contribution of the forest to the economic. But I will take a look at what he did and see if that might be pertinent to what we're talking about.
Okay, that would be helpful.
The report, 96, that was a while ago.
Yeah, that would be
cool.
Yeah. Okay, so then based on some of that feedback, I can embellish some of the write-up on economic conditions that would be good. And then now we're down to the one about identifying some of the environmental justice concerns. And I'm really open to any feedback that you have about your knowledge in the area of environmental justice.
So can we set the stage for what that means?
Well, Thurville, it took an enormously long time for them to get any traction on getting water to them when they were without water. That's a really basic issue that I think is environmental justice, because no one really paid much attention to them until they really began to rally people who could go to their assistance and really represent them better.
East Porterville ran out of water in 2015 or 2014,
and they had asked, not our earworm group, but they had asked the county to help them. And they did not get assistance for about a year or more. And they were without water in their home for about a year. And so I think that if we're talking about environmental justice, what are we talking about?
Well, that,
you know, that part of the reservation communities don't get services that they need, basic services that the rest of us take for granted.
Okay, I have to put my lab coat hat on here. Because I personally, the commission level, county level, dealt with those issues over a couple of years' time. There is a series of different issues here and a long history whereby East Porterville for a very long time was not interested in being annexed to the city of Porterville, and the city of Porterville didn't have a lot of interest in annexing East Porterville. Long history here. And you're right, there were wells that were 15 and 60 feet deep in East Porterville that went dry. And there were a large number of households, most of them renters, that had to use a 300 or 500 gallon storage, I thought the capacity was, and it took a while to get that system, if you want to call it that, set up. There were no institutions that could, under code, provide a new water system. City of Porterville stepped up and said, okay, extraterritorial service agreement, and ESA, another version of what ESA is. The city applied to the state for grant funds, they had to sink a new well. They did that. All of that does take time, and people who are dealing with water stored on their front lawn is not fun. But in terms of pointing at fingers and saying, bad people, you didn't do your duty, that's where I get a little hot on the collar. Because there were many players in this particular situation, and the fact of the matter is, the city of Porterville did step up, did get the grant money from the state to sink that well, did expedite putting the pipes in the ground, and through a phased development of that system, went through the community. Now, there were some people who still didn't want city water, because they did not want to be annexed to the city later on. So some folks are without water, but you know, they didn't want it. So if we're going to point fingers, you've got to point them in a number of different directions and not say the county should provide the service.
So I want to move on from this particular piece of this agenda item, but I think it's really important for us as an action item, as a group, to take this back and let's consider what environmental justice items we have to deal with. In our part of the environmental justice has to do with access to open space. In our region, that's most of the time not a problem. It does have access to do with basic services. That is a significant challenge and a problem in our region. We have some, in particular, I want to raise the issue of tribal water. And we've had this issue of tribal water rights come up. And I think that was an important aspect of the Tule River Indian Reservation took on as to try to gain some tribal water. So that's a big
question.
That's a big issue. I think that is common among our tribal groups in our region. And the other part of that same piece is we're now just starting to address getting in line with some of the issues that you have. And that could be our tribal groups or even some of our disadvantaged communities. We still struggle to understand exactly what and so some of the considerations relate to the fact that they may have folks in communities may have a populace for which they do not know if they have adequate water supply. we have a couple of entities where we know that's true. And the solution is a lot of times to dig the deal, well, deeper. Well, it turns out we have some areas that you can't do that. So there's uranium and some of these other considerations. But I just wanted to bring that up as one of the pressing things I keep hearing about.
And to get back to your earlier question about the basic, what is environmental justice, I think if I could just get tactfully to the point of what the guidelines are suggesting to talk about there is, is there somebody in this group, Bobby, maybe it's you, I don't know, that can talk about what this group has done to engage stakeholders to find out what the EJ concerns actually are? And if we have, you know, what would be our plan to do that? I think that would be what we need to talk about here. And then following that, what the ideas are for remedying those, you know, action plans or projects that might be needed to remedy those issues, I think is what we need to be talking about in that section. And you'll see my note, you know, in the track changes about that, but further your thoughts. Okay, going on, the next section we need some feedback on is a section that's titled Problems and Priorities for Disadvantaged Communities, so it's kind of like going to the next step. What does IRWIC want to prioritize to address that problem? So once you've identified what some of the remediation efforts might be, how do you want to then some plan about how you will prioritize those?
Yeah, so I think that's probably one of our most difficult questions, frankly. And the reason for that is that we have a current priority and tiered system for our project implementation, which relies on the most ready project being able to, you know, basically carry a project forward where it's ready, the most ready project to go forward. But we also recognize at the same time that VACs, they by nature and some of these other VAs are going to be at a disadvantage relative to other projects.
Yeah, and there's some text in here that's highlighted that you can consider whether it's applicable in this area or not. I suspect most of them probably are. Things as basic as lack of computer technology to receive information or to send out information or to ask for help. A presentation of information. How do you disseminate information to these areas and have them be able to absorb it in a meaningful way? Well, that's kind of the stuff that's listed here. So, just like your feedback on what you think these are applicable in this area that they come up for me.
And to a certain extent, the state is helping with this because they have a lot of DAC funding now, you know, money that's just for DAC. So that's helping them out.
Right, but my point again is that the funding alone does not absolve the issue. In fact, it can exacerbate it. And that's because not everybody has access, because of these things, to that. So we don't have an ultimate solution to, you know, the most disadvantaged groups in our region. We don't currently, and we want to take some feedback and ideas about how to do that, but again, social media and technology, but then we have some areas. For example, I had to hook up to a DSL line that was at the lowest DSL level, and I was at the 15,000 foot mark. Before that, I was 56K per minute.
Yeah, and then there's some other things in here that.
It's true, Owen, I swear.
I believe you.
Where we talk about, you know, obstacles for disadvantaged communities. Operational side of it, where they don't have the technical or managerial scale of power within their community to actually handle becoming a water system. They don't have enough people that would sit on a board. They don't have enough people who could manage the system. So anyway, read through this and give me your feedback if you think any of this is applicable, and we'll leave it in there. If you think it's not applicable, we'll take it out. When are you sending this out? Pardon? When are you sending this out? I'm going to try to get this out next week, you guys.
Okay, so that's an action item proposed, Richard. Is that next week? sometime they're going to send out Chapter 16 in draft form, be disseminated. And then there are some key questions of points of engagement that they're asking for, fairly specific on that. Obviously, it's not limited to that. They're tearing up some points of engagement.
Yeah, and again, some of the other things that we need to think about how we write this up, the sort of bullet points, the 2016 guideline requirements are asking, do we have a way to illustrate to our DACs what the decision-making process is so they can understand how they can engage with us and how this group can benefit them being engaged, that kind of thing. And then just the big question is determining the priorities for addressing DAC and being.
Do you have a figure? And we do have a brochure.
Okay.
So those are two elements that you get that specifically. And there may be some other things like through the website and other things.
Can you send me those?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Those would be great things.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the brochure was in the previous plan as an appendix.
Okay.
And then we may have used that figure somewhere. So I'll resend those. So the action item is for Bob here to send the governance diagram and then to send the brochure.
So are these DACs that I've identified so far, maybe you could give me this in your feedback, are they part of the distribution list?
Most of our DACs, with a few exceptions, have at least one representative from the community or nearby. Some are obviously way more represented than others. For example, we've had trouble reaching places like POSI, a few others. But we've also done workshops in some of the places like we did one. In the community that's just north of Kernville, actually, that is in our region.
Yeah.
They don't come from the community.
Yeah.
If they're on the email list.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess I can see where it would be troublesome if it's a small community of residences that are all on private wells and there's no chamber of commerce. Who do you contact except each of the individual property owners, right? So maybe we need to think about a way to have an outreach.
Yeah, so I think we've got a list of the mutual water companies at some point in time, and that's one point of engagement.
Yeah,
we've done some work in that regard. That's a good point. But yeah, that could be something, an action item in the plan for us to do, a new strategy. We'd be working a little bit more closely with those. Again, the issue we have is there are so many of them, how we need to run. That's this issue right there. And that is our most serious issue, I think so. We know the problems, we're coming up with maybe some more solutions, but then how do we implement this?
Well, I think what you do is if you have a robust outreach plan, if you make sure you're at least contacting people, those that come back to us and make noise, those become the priorities, I think, in that simplistic way.
But again, my point there in pointing that out is we have to be careful about that, because folks have capacity to make noise. Other folks are trying to meet. They don't have time to make noise.
Yeah.
So I just want to be careful about that. Definitely. I get caught doing that too.
Yeah.
And then it's easy to do that. Oh, let's make that. We actually have to go a little deeper. And recognizing what I just talked about, I think, essential for that.
So some kind of tricky issues. So any feedback that you can give me in that regard, you can
build a solid topic that would be helpful. So we want to talk timelines here. We have just a couple of minutes left. And most of our project updates are very simple and quick, so we'll get through this. But I want to talk about, we want to set some time frame for Ryan to get his products in. We want to then be able to circulate some draft components to this early as an assembled draft IRWM key, and then get that out for public comment. Then we have to meet, discuss those public comments and respond to them, and then we have to circulate it. Modified draft. So right now it looks like that we would be giving Ryan a good portion of get some of the report done in June, right?
I was thinking, yeah.
In 2 weeks, you know, I can put a deadline for myself for the report.
Full draft report, 2 weeks.
The 15.3.
The study or the chapter?
The chapter. I'll go through the report.
You want to jump to the next?
I can go through what I've written already. I'll add in the missing pieces that are the missing analyses. So I'll be done with the bulk of
all of it up to put into there. And maybe, and also look at the other sections that we referenced, like 15.6, I believe. And I'll try to have that in 2 weeks, on June 22nd, if that works. And then I'll aim for a draft of the report. Let's think it 3 weeks later, July 13th. Would be a,
and there you're talking about the complete study that's going to be in appendix.
Basically, I'll have a draft of the final, the what will happen be in the appendix. And then that way, if anyone has any comments or you guys look it over, and then I can have the final appendix report done a week before the draft next. August 10th.
What was the date you identified for 3 weeks later for the draft?
July 13th.
We have a, in your agenda, you'll see that we had a coordinating meeting on August 17th and requested Brian to send final materials a week before that so we can have the coordinating meeting look that over, and then that will be, you know, that's the September 6th meeting prep, as it were, to get that ready, and that will be circulated. The idea, I think, that Mary floated was to give folks a month before the September 6th deadline, right, which would be August 6th. So that should fit pretty closely into all of that, right?
Okay, to be clear, let's back up just a little bit, because I understand the confusion. So, next week, I'm going to send you chapter 16. Talked about getting response from all the prior action items by June 21st. But I think you're probably going to need a little bit more time on chapter 16. So a week after that, so you'll have an extra week there, I think would be helpful for chapter 16.
That's the
28th. So that'd be by the 28th. So all the lingering action items of previous chapters that we've talked about, and sending links and exchanging all that kind of stuff, we want in 2 weeks. And then the week after that, I'd like to have your feedback on chapter 16, which I will get out next week. So you'll have 2 weeks on that one.
Okay. I'll try. Okay. Bobby, I do have a more fundamental question.
No, just cancel it out. Just ignore that.
Yeah.
Exactly. That, that was our end goal a year ago when we planned this work plan out.
Okay, I'm sorry. Now, what did my viewers thought? What is that date now? Sometime, I assume, after September.
You just said August
28th,
so.
Yeah.
Have all your information back to you by August 28th?
So we won't have Ryan's input on chapter 15 until 6:22, which is, and then we won't have committee feedback on 16, chapter 16 until the 28th. So I need some time after that to put together the whole composite Irwin. Chapters we didn't touch, as well as all the chapters we did touch, and get that out to you. And are we saying that that version is going to be subject to public review, or do we want to get the input again first on that?
Well, what we did before was, because we have preliminary approval, folks were good if they were offered a final opportunity, a single final opportunity to comment on the compiled plan. That's how we did that. That's why we sought preliminary approval, so you guys could compile, propose that as a full plan, and they could offer any final comment at that point. All right.
And so then, after they package taking that final look at it, then it goes out for a 30-day review, public. And we're going to do that after September 6th, right?
Right. I think that's right, because what we want to do here is, as your proposal a month before,
Ryan has a deadline for his piece for the coordinating meeting, which is about the 11th or the 10th of August.
Right.
So that's pretty close to a month, right? If we can compile that, if we get a little bit of a blow that deadline a little bit. Why? Because you need to compile or some last final thinking. It seems
realistically
like that's
realistically give us, you know, 2.5-3 weeks.
Okay, so let's figure something reasonable out.
Right,
let's. On the bullet list, we could move.
Talking through that a little bit more, Julie, there's another 30-day review period that has to happen, I understand, after we respond to public comments. What's our real drop dead date to submit this thing to the state is what now, December?
The contract says December 31st.
I don't think to say that because we want to get it in long before that if we can.
Right, because the other deadlines that they have,
yes,
to on, you have to have it approved by your group and submitted to DWR before you can apply for funding implementation grants.
Right.
And they're trying to get that out.
Basic framework here for the deadlines for Ryan. My question is very how much time do we need to compile this? We don't need, we can punt this decision. We'd like to have a plan, we have a rough one into August. Maybe what you can do is go back and see what it really is going to take you. So that we're not making something that's going to stress you out or create an unusual deadline. And the question really is how much time do you need to compile after you get material from Ryan? You know, if you're going to get two big batches of material, there may be some integrating things you need to do as it relates to
the
final piece.
So first, I mean, I don't know what you have to do for the final report if that just gets stuck on the end. Because, I mean, I'll do the chapter stuff and try to do it in 2 weeks. That's, I think, the harder part.
Yes.
Well, I think rather than me deciding whether what Ryan does is acceptable or not, I would just take what he gives me line and put it into the composite document to send out, and that would be the chance for the whole group to take that next month to look at that. And the focus for you guys, I think, is going to be the last three chapters that we talked about today. Because you've seen the other six twice now, you know, so I can't imagine that there's going to be a lot of commentary about those. So in that last month of review for you, I think it's
So that looks like, you know, later than say 3 weeks before that September, what's that look like for date?
3 weeks before September 6th.
So that's the day before our coordinating committee meeting. So these all dates are coalescing from the 16th. And obviously earlier is great, but that really had that as a target, right?
I can't wait to see you write this up.
We are recording this.
August 16th.
So, any other outstanding items on the plan?
Yeah, let's just do that again when he did that. What's the August 16th event, the target date for me to get the review draft to us?
Yep, compiled and out. That's the review draft. Okay, final piece here is that I got a note from the administrator for the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation funding. There was $3 million in the Kings River watershed for wetland improvement. It is now gone. Spoken for. So I'm hoping that's on federal land. And I'm hoping our friends Josh and Ann from Sierra Napa Forest, they took it all. They had three great meadow projects, and their funding request was roughly that. Okay, final one is Nina still on the phone? Did you jump off? Okay.
So finally,
yes, I am.
Awesome. So do you have an update on any NIFWIF funding, or do you have any update on your Fish Creek Bridge or any of that?
Nothing on NIFWIF funding. We're finishing up the Ten Meadows EA, getting it ready to send out to the public. And I had talked to Council Fish and Wildlife about it, so they gave a presentation at the Sierra Meadows meeting that was last week. And everyone seemed to be really excited about being able to fund the implementation of some of those meadows, because the Cal Fish and Wildlife Prop 1 funds are going to be solely for implementation this time around. No planning dollars are going to be involved in it. So, and then I'm thinking that the assessment that Cal Trout did should be moved forward, and we'll try and get implementation dollars to start, not implementation dollars, but dollars to start planning for those. But right now, my goal is just to finish the first set of meadows that we started on with Trout Unlimited. So anyway, oh, and the Sierra Meadows conference was very interesting, and when I start to get products out of that, I'll send them on to the group.
That sounds great. Thanks for the update, Nina. Thank you for your patience. We're a little bit over time today. 12 minutes over time. That's my record for blowing the schedule. Sorry about that. Thank you all for being here today, for your contributions. And we are adjourned. Thanks, folks on the phone. Jeannie's going to bring her gavel next time. Thanks, everyone on the phone.
Hey, it's
Sarah.
It's my file.
I won't let you take any out.
I'll put my updated chapter.
I'm still trying to think, where is it?